You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Jesse Rutledge talked about how Virginia and other states select their state court judges and the advantages and disadvantages of each method. In this podcast, you'll learn how many states let their people pick their judges through popular elections and what the U.S. Supreme Court had to say about freedom of speech when judges must also be candidates like other politicians. Is there a way to get politics out of how judges are chosen? Jesse Rutledge is Vice President for External Affairs at the National Center for State Courts in Williamsburg, Virginia. At NCSC, he oversees the organization's communications, marketing, information services, associations, conferences, and private development efforts. Mr. Rutledge spoke at the Wednesday, December 9th, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Terry Cooper. Our podcast is entitled, How We Choose Our Judges. Here's Terry Cooper.
Our topic today is selection of state court judges. And you might think, well, why should I be interested in that? I'm not a courtroom lawyer. I don't have any cases pending in the courts, and I hope my will goes through probate without a contest. Well, let me explain something. Judges can be a quality of life issue. Not many years ago, in the state of Mississippi, the state court judges were such handmaidens to the plaintiff's bar that Mississippi was in danger of going without a single OBGYN in the state. So, as I say, judicial selection can be a quality of life issue. Our speaker today is Jesse Rutledge from the National Center for State Courts, where he is Vice President for External Affairs. The National Center for State Courts has as its mission improving the administration of justice at state courts throughout the nation. And Jesse's going to talk with us about how Virginia selects its state court judges and other states and the pros and cons of each. So please join me in welcoming Jesse Rutledge.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for that lovely introduction, Terry. Thank you, Bob, and thanks to Jim for being my AV guy who's going to keep everything running smooth today, at least I hope so. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I think we have had this on the calendar for quite a few months now, and so I hope it's going to be a topic that is interesting to you. It's certainly interesting to me. It's what I do every day. And I'm going to spend some time walking through the four major kinds of systems that the states use to pick their judges. So before I get going, let me just mention a couple of things. So for one thing, this is my cell phone up here. I don't want you to think that I'm standing here checking my email if I look at it. I keep it up here because I'm from the generation that this is also my timepiece. So if I have to quickly look at the time, that's what I'm doing. I'm not being rude, I promise. The other day, I was coming back from a conference on the West Coast, and it had been a long day, and flown from San Francisco through to Atlanta, and then got on an airplane in Atlanta, and I was coming back, landing in Richmond, and we were landing quite late. It was probably close to midnight by the time I got there. And we came in, and it was not the greatest landing that I've ever had in my life. And there were some people who were a little shook up by the landing. It sort of felt like maybe it was on one wheel, and then it bounced around a little bit. Then we got to the gate, and everything was fine, and we were deplaning. And there was this lady who had been sitting next to me on this flight, and she was, I will say, she was a contemporary of yours. She was probably in her or 60s or 70s. I don't know exactly what, but we were getting off the airplane, and I was walking behind her, following her off. And you know how the pilot always comes out and will stand right there and say, you know, thank you for flying our airline? So the pilot is a young man, younger than me, probably late 20s, early 30s. And he says, thank you so much for flying with us. And this lady says to him, and just made me laugh, this lady says to him, son, let me ask you a question. Did you land this airplane, or were we shot down? So, it may have been midnight, but she still had her wits about her. It was a rough landing. I got off the airplane, and I live in Williamsburg. Drove home to Williamsburg, and everything was fine. So my organization, the National Center for State Courts, probably an organization that none of you have heard of until right now. And there's probably no compelling reason why you should have. But I want to take a couple of minutes to tell you a bit about who we are and where we came from and what we do. We are based in Williamsburg, and we're a national not-for-profit organization, which means that we work in all 50 states and in the territories as well. And so we have a lot of staff who are, all across the country working in courts in all 50 states. And you hear the name of our organization and you think, shouldn't you be in Washington, D.C.? I mean, this sure sounds like an organization that belongs in Washington rather than in Williamsburg. And we have kind of a curious history because we have pretty much always been in Williamsburg since the early 70s when we were founded. And the organization was established in 1971 or 72, I forget exactly when, after a conference in Williamsburg that was hosted by the United States Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was very interested in advancing not just jurisprudence, but in how justice was administered around the country. That was one of his great passions. And he had as another one of his passions a love of colonial Williamsburg. So they hosted this national conference, and the Chief Justice said, well, we're going to have it in Williamsburg. So they did. The meeting, at that meeting, they called for an organization to be created that would support the state courts. And a year or two went by, and they came up with some criteria for places where this organization should be located. And it had to be located near a major airport, in the center of the country, and adjacent to a major law school. And so they picked Williamsburg, of course. makes all the sense in the world. We actually are right next to the William & Mary Law School. We are on the campus adjacent to William & Mary. So they got one of the three criteria correct. But the other two, I think, went by the wayside when the Chief Justice said, let's have it in Williamsburg. And everybody said, yep, yes, sir. Well, what do? We are an organization that is funded through numerous sources. We do direct work in the states with state courts and state court systems all around the country. We get funds for specific projects. If a court in Tahoe County, Nevada, decides that they want to look at how they are going to improve how they choose their jurors, they will contact us. And we have experts and researchers and consultants who know all about how to do this sort of thing. So we do work directly with the states. We do continuing education, which means that we work with the state court judges and the staff over the course of the year to make sure that they are getting the continuing education they need so that they can do their jobs better. We host conferences. We do research. We conduct technical assistance. We do all these things. And we've got our headquarters in Williamsburg, and then we've got three other satellite offices. And one of them is in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, where we have a very small office that works in government affairs. We have a major office in Denver, Colorado, which has about 30 full-time consultants. And these are the people who spend all their lives flying around, helping courts solve their problems every day. And then we also have another office in Arlington, Virginia, fairly close to the headquarters of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Anybody guess why? Well, it's because we do a lot of work overseas, and we get funded by USAID to do this kind of work, not just in the 50 states, but in places like in the last few years, we've had work in Lebanon, in Kosovo, in Haiti, and in other countries that are looking to develop their democracies and strengthen their rule of law. So this is a bit about the organization that I work for. That was loud. And today, what I'm going to talk to you about is the systems for choosing judges in the 50 states. And I have to begin by issuing my required caveat, which is my organization is a nonpartisan organization. And when it comes to this particular topic, we do a lot of information gathering, we conduct a lot of research, we do a lot of analysis. Our organization does not take a position on which of these systems is the best one. So I'm going to spend some time talking to you today about the various systems, and we're going to go through the pros and the cons of these different systems. But I don't want you to infer from anything that I say that our organization thinks that one is better than the other, because we work for all 50 states. They all have different systems. It's what gives us full employment, is trying to sort out all the details. So we don't have a strong view that one is better than the other. I'm already behind on my slides. So that's the topic for today, choosing state judges, the pros and cons of the various methods. This is the logo for our organization. And to begin the conversation, I want us to think collectively about what is the role of the judge in American life? Because when you start thinking about how the men and women get there, it's worth stopping and thinking, well, what do they do and why are they there? What is their role? I know what I don't want in a judge. I don't ever want to go into a courtroom and have to face Judge Judy. That is the opposite of what I want. She is a great actor, and she did used to be a judge. And she makes $50 million a year pretending to be a judge. She is the highest paid television celebrity in the country, $50 million to be Judge Judy, to be rude, to be disgraceful, to not listen to the people who come before you. But it does make for great TV, right? I mean, we do all watch it. But presumably what we want is the opposite of Judge Judy. What do we expect our judges, our real judges, to do? Well, we expect them to listen. It's a big part of being a judge, is listening to those who come before you to tell their side of the story. We want them to have an open mind. We don't want them to come onto the court with their own preconceived notions about rights or wrongs, or about facts of a case they've already decided in their head. We want them to consider every case fairly and impartially based on the facts and the law. We want them to follow the law. That's another important role for a judge. We don't want them to be making up their own law or interpreting it based on their own political whims or their personal predilections. We want them to follow the law that's been written. And above all, I say what we want judges to do is we want them to uphold the Constitution. That is their perhaps their most important function in our society, is to make sure that our laws and ultimately our Constitution, whether that's the United States Constitution or whether it's a constitution of a state, is followed and upheld. Now, do they do this perfectly all the time? No, of course they don't. But that is, I think, probably what we would agree we want from our judges. We want them to be listeners. We want them to be open-minded. We want them to follow the law. We want them to uphold the Constitution. So if you accept those premises as the things that we want from our judges, then let's talk for a couple of minutes about the values that are lie behind how we choose our judges. And in order to accomplish this role of being fair and impartial and upholding the rule of law, I think that we seek to infuse the American court system, the American judiciary, with two values. And these values sometimes are at tension with each other. So the first value is independence. We want our judges to be independent so that they can do their job of deciding one case at a time, right? We want them, as I've said, to rule solely based on the facts and the law. And we want them to be unaffected by outside pressures. And like everybody, judges are people, and they have their own opinions, their own views. We want them to set them aside, and if they do that, we grant them this independence. But we also want them to be unaffected by other outside pressures like politics. And that could be their own political views, or it could be political pressure they might feel. We want them to be independent from financial incentives that they might have to rule on cases certain ways. They need to be apart from that. That should not be part of the consideration when they're ruling on a case. And as I've said, of course, their own personal beliefs should be set aside. So what do? We afford our judges the independence to make the right choice in every case. So independence, in my view, is a key value that we think should underpin the American court system. But that's not the only one. There's another one, and oftentimes this other one competes with independence, and that is accountability. To a certain degree, these are two sides of the same coin, right? And we want the judges to be both independent and accountable. Judges are still public officials. They're not unaccountable, and you certainly hear an awful lot in the media when controversial decisions come out that somebody does not like for political reasons. They will talk about how the judges are out of control and they're activist judges. I like to say that an activist judge is a judge who makes a decision you don't like, and that's what an activist judge is. That's all it really means. But we want judges to be accountable, and so we build into our system of how they are chosen accountability mechanisms. I think this is for me. There are a lot of ways in which judges are accountable, even though they are oftentimes beaten up on TV or in the media for being unaccountable. I want to talk for a few minutes about how judges are accountable, and you tell me if you can think of a more accountable branch of government. So the first accountability mechanism that exists is that judges have to explain their decisions, and they have to do that either verbally, orally, in a courtroom. When they make a decision, they have to explain why they feel that way. Or they have to write an opinion. They have to put in words why it is they justify making the decision that they do. Can you imagine our legislature, any legislature, I'm not saying Virginia, I'm saying any legislature, where before you cast a vote, you had to write down why you voted that way? Never happen. So the decision-making process has built into it an accountability mechanism right there. But there are others. Almost every decision that comes out of a courtroom in this country can be appealed to a higher court. Until you get all the way up to the United States Supreme Court and you get into the area that Dahlia Lithwick was talking with you about last month. You know, otherwise, pretty much every case in this country can be appealed. It's not to say that it should be or will be, but that check is there. You don't like your decision, you could take it up the food chain. A further mechanism for accountability is that judges, even ones who have been on the bench for a long, long time, can be sanctioned or removed for unethical behavior. And every state has a body, which is called something like a Judicial Standards Commission, And that body works around the clock, making sure that judges are following the code of judicial ethics. Every state has a code of judicial ethics to which judges are bound, and that body makes sure that the judges do that. So those are three ways in which your judges are very accountable for the work that they do. And again, I would argue more accountable than the other branches of government, at least with those checks in place. But the ultimate form of accountability comes in the form of how judges are selected and then reselected or not reselected. And so that is something that you'll see runs through the course of my remarks here as we look at how these two values compete. We want them to be independent. We don't want them to feel political pressure. We want them to be able to make the right decision based on the facts and the law. But we don't want them running off, making up their own minds on things, or succumbing to political pressure or other financial pressure. And so we have to have ways in which judges are accountable and can be either sanctioned or removed from office. So that really constitutes a good segue for us to move into some of the more specific conversation about what's happening around the different kinds of judicial selection systems. I feel like I have to give a lot of caveats about things I'm going to say, because when you try and take a system that encompasses 30,000 state judges and boil it down to four slides or five slides, you're making a lot of assumptions. And so just be aware that there's a lot of gray area, and what I've tried to do is organize this content in a way that it makes sense for us to have a conversation about. So it's not a mess of 400 slides and 400 different details. And so you're going to see that I've taken the 50 states and I've grouped them into effectively four different kinds of selection systems. And by doing that, hopefully we can do some comparing and contrasting on the good parts and the bad parts of each of these systems. But each system and each state has little details that I'm not going to cover here. And there are very few states that mirror each other in how they do this. And so when you get down into the granular details, there are a lot of them. I'm going to gloss over those. Keep that in mind. And if you have any specific questions about things that I might have skipped over, just let me know. So with that said, the first system that I want to touch on is the one that we use right here in the state of Virginia. And that is, we choose our state court judges through legislative elections, meaning that the Virginia legislature votes up or down on every single nominee for a judgeship in this state. And it is an unusual system in that there are only two states in the country that use this method. The other state is South Carolina. And it makes for fascinating study, because when we can look at some of the other systems and see 15 or 20 different states using other systems, here we've got two. And so we only know as much as we know about Virginia and South Carolina when it comes to legislative elections. The pro side to using your legislature to choose your judges is that when there is concentrated power in the legislature, or even when there's not, but when there's comity, things tend to move along pretty fast. And you can very quickly get your judges selected and placed on the bench. And the system sort of moves along, and it doesn't necessarily grind to the same kind of halt that we've seen happen with federal judges, where those judgeships can stay open for a long time, for months or years, because the political parties can't agree on the right people for those positions. So it can be fast, and that can be a good thing. Now, that has not necessarily been the case here in Virginia for the last number of years. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the recent history here in the state, But when the recession hit back in 2008, 2009, we sort of fell behind, and they stopped reappointing some of the judges to save money because they couldn't fund the positions. They didn't want to have to find ways to fund those positions. And so principally through attrition, when judges retired, they did not fill those positions. And so that resulted in a little bit of a disparity between the workload and the number of cases to be heard and the number of sitting judges. Now, the legislature here in Virginia has made strides forward. They have increased the number of judgeships over the last couple of years to reflect this growing workload. And then there's the second step. You can create the position on paper, then you have to fund it. And sometimes those two things don't line up. So you can pass a piece of legislation but not fund it, and that means that you can't go and put somebody in that position. So there has been some discrepancy there between the positions that exist on paper and the positions that are funded. And we're getting, I think, in Virginia, we're kind of getting back to more of a sense of normal. But this legislature, the relationship between this legislature and the current governor can be a pretty frosty one. And so things have not always moved smoothly, and there is an ongoing battle over a member of the state Supreme Court who was made an interim appointment by the governor, and legislative leadership is essentially refusing to conduct the election to confirm that individual to the seat, and they have suggested appointing somebody else. This is the sort of thing that happens when you don't have agreement and concentrated power. And so things tend to slow down, and it tends to look political. But there are some other good sides, and you're going to see as I walk through some of the other methods that the other methods have a lot of downsides. It's not all rosy in other systems. And so by having the legislature take care of this process, we are avoiding some of the problems that you will see documented when we talk about the role of more pure political appointments and of popular elections. Let me move on to, so that's system number one, legislative elections, and that is two states. Second method is a form of appointment with no retention election, and I'm going to explain in a second in a little more detail exactly what a retention election is. But this is the system that I would describe as probably closest to the federal model, where there is an appointment made usually by an executive branch official, usually a governor, and that individual takes judicial office, sometimes with the consent of the legislature or a legislative panel, sometimes without. Again, I'm talking about all these gray areas. But conceptually, the governor makes the choice, and the person goes into office. And I was having a conversation a moment ago when I walked in here about one of your colleagues who has a son who was just appointed as a judge in Massachusetts. And he's going to be there for as long as he's well-behaved, presumably, right? That's part of the system in Massachusetts, is lifetime appointment, which gives you some sense of why it looks a little bit like the federal model. There are definitely some upsides to this sort of system. For one thing, comparing it to the legislative elections, it gets it a little bit out of the hurly-burly of the power politics of the legislature. Not that there's not politics in who the governor chooses, of course, but it's perhaps not as apparent in public debate. And some of the states that use this system will use a commission. It's called a screening commission to help make sure that the candidates who are being picked by the governor have been vetted and that they are well qualified to be judges. That's not always the case. In some states, it's truly gubernatorial discretion, and they can pick their friends, they can pick their general counsel, they can pick somebody who worked in their campaign. This all happened, trust me. But in a lot of these situations, in these appointment states, there is a little bit of a filter or a screen to make sure that the people who are being appointed are going to be qualified for the work. The probably the con might be, many would argue, is on the accountability side. And you can certainly argue that, that this system might be where independence is the greatest of the two values, right? If these are, if you use the analogy of scales of justice, and on one side you've got independence, and on one side you've got accountability. In this system, for the most part, we are trusting our judges to be independent, and we are limiting the accountability to essentially just being removed for office for, you know, really poor behavior, which does happen, but it doesn't happen very often. So again, I want you to think about each of these systems and think about, okay, where is that balance between independence or accountability? And here we have more independence. One of the downsides of that, arguably, is that the ability to remove judges in the system is very limited. And there is no popular input or review. And by that I mean the people as a whole do not have a say. You could argue that in a legislative system, you've got your legislators who are representing the will of the people with their votes. That's representative democracy that we work in. And in some of the systems I'm going to describe going forward, you get into direct elections. People have a very strong ability to make their choices. But in this system, with an appointment and with some sort of confirmation and usually some sort of long-term or lifetime appointment, there is no input from the people to speak of. So many would argue that that's a downside and that puts too much emphasis on independence and not enough on accountability. System number three is perhaps a term that you've heard. This is a nomenclature that is fairly popular in the judicial courts world. There is a system that is called the Missouri Plan. And I know this will be a shocking revelation. It's called that because it was developed in Missouri. That's right. Missouri. And I want to say this was developed in the 50s. And they tried to put together a new system for selecting judges because they were so concerned that their judges were corrupt that they wanted to put together a new way that put more emphasis on accountability while maintaining some independence. So I need to explain a couple of the details about the features of this system so that we can have a review of where it is on the independence versus accountability scale. In the Missouri Plan system, which is used in 16 states for state Supreme Court judges, there is a something called the Judicial Nominating Commission, and that's similar to what I was mentioning a moment ago, which is a body usually of, say, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 individuals. And their job is to screen candidates for judgeships in the states. And these commissions are naturally sort of political animals, different in every state. But typically, the people who get onto these commissions are members of the state bar, so designees of the State Bar Association. Sometimes I think you can have plaintiffs, attorneys, trial lawyer groups will get a seat at the table. You will almost certainly have political representation, and so the governor might appoint somebody to sit on this commission. The speaker of the House or the Assembly and the legislature will get to appoint somebody. President of the Senate gets to appoint somebody. The idea is you build a screening body that is somewhat representative of various interests and that knows what to look for when they're looking for a good judge. So this body gets constituted, and when a judgeship becomes open, they receive applications. And anybody who is qualified to be a judge in the state, in almost all states that requires you to be an attorney, some states you have to be of a certain age to apply for a judgeship. They go to this group, and this group reviews all the candidates, and they will then choose, like a job interview, they choose a certain number that they want to talk to, and they bring them in, and they have interviews, and they talk about their approach to jurisprudence. They talk about their judicial philosophy. They talk about all kinds of things that are relevant to how good a judge you'll be, get a sense of where this person is on the judicial philosophy spectrum. And after they conduct these interviews, the nominating commission then huddles, and they send finalists for the position to the governor. And they can send them three, they can send them five. It varies by state. Three is the most common. And then the governor gets the three finalists, and he or she will conduct his or her own interviews and do another process with those candidates. And then the governor will make the choice. So look, this is a little bit different from the previous system that I described, where the governor sort of can handpick the people that he or she wants. Here, their pool is limited by this system that has been put in place to filter to presumably the best candidates. So the governor then makes their choice. The judge goes on to the bench and will have a short initial term. And usually it's somewhere between 12 months and 18 months. And it's usually built around a term that goes from when they're appointed to the next popular statewide election. And that's when the final piece of the process comes into play. Because after you've gone through your interviews with the nominating commission and been referred to the governor, and gone through your interview with the governor and been chosen for the judgeship, you go on the bench. And then when it comes election time, your name appears on the ballot. But here's what's different. Your name doesn't appear next to anybody else's name. Your name appears with a yes or no next to it. And the question that is posed to the voters is, should Judge Terry Cooper be retained for a full term or for another term as a judge? And the voters have the final say on whether that judge stays on the bench for another term or whether that judge does not stay on the bench for another term. There is a lot of history here that suggests that these elections, they are elections. People get a chance to come and vote. But that it has historically been very seldom that a judge is defeated. For the most part, we see voters coming in. They probably don't know who the person is. They don't have another candidate to vote for. They're not guided by any cues on the ballot like a political party. And so for the most part, voters have historically said, yes, retain the judge. And assuming that's the case, then Judge Cooper gets to sit for 10 years. And then the next time 10 years comes up, their name goes back on the ballot. And the question is posed again. Now, I see some hands. I've been asked to save questions for the end so that we can capture everything for the podcast. But if this judge loses and people vote no and say, you know, this judge is a bad judge, then the whole system starts again. The judge is off the court and they go back to the vacancy that goes back to the nominating commission, applications, screening, appointment, election. So that is the cycle that exists in the Missouri plan. And there is another name for this plan, which is a controversial term. But in these states, the judges prefer to refer to it as merit selection. And so it's a nice term. And if you were a judge in one of these states, you would probably like to say, I was chosen on merit. Merit of the process. My merit to be the right person for this job. So Missouri plan, merit selection. Of course, when you talk to judges in systems other than this one, they don't quite care for the term merit selection in other states, particularly when you talk about popular election. got a lot of judges who say to me, my merit was chosen by the voters. So that's, you can see this is a, could be a delicate term. So as I said, for the most part, historically, over the 50 or 60 years that this system has been in place and has expanded to other states, these have been retention elections that have been pretty quiet, and very seldom do those elections look anything like a regular political election or even a contested judicial election that I'm going to spend some time talking about in just a minute. But things are changing. Things are always changing in American politics, and there has been a significant change in the last 10 to 15 years in the number of these retention elections that have turned into actual campaigns. And here's the data that backs that up. I'm going to show you a graph that shows how much money has been spent in aggregate in these retention elections where the candidate has no opponent. And you can see that in the 2001-2002 cycle, which is the far left, there was $259,000 spent nationwide on retention elections. And in the most recent election cycle, 2013-2014, that's the far right, I can't even quite read that number, about $6.5 million on retention elections. And so that marks a change in how many of these campaigns are being run. And that's not to say that most of them are not still pretty tame affairs with very little going on. But in more and more of these campaigns, the judges are being criticized. And that's kind of where the money comes into these retention election campaigns is people who don't like how the judge has ruled or do not feel that the judge is doing a good job or are not disposed to that judge's particular political or judicial philosophy, they have started to spend money, usually through what are called independent expenditure campaigns, running television ads, running direct mail campaigns, pieces of mail that might get in your mailbox, getting robocalls when somebody calls you, say, you know, I'm whoever I am, and I'm telling you to vote for or don't vote for so-and-so. So things are changing with these retention elections to the point where more people are paying attention to what's going on, and they are becoming a little more political than they used to be. Though on balance, really, they're still relatively calm. And I don't know, I can't think of more than five judges that I've heard of who have lost a retention election in the last 5 years. So it's pretty uncommon still. Now, the fourth and final system, well, before I move on to the fourth and final system, let me weigh out the independence versus accountability spectrum here for this merit selection system. And the advocates for this system, the designers of this system, will tell you that they put this plan together to try to get that balance just right, because they believe that the judges should have independence, and that's why they want to make sure that they are screening correctly on the front end of the process. But they also believe that bad candidates could get through there, and that the voters should have the ultimate final say in accountability. And so this system, to hear the proponents talk about it, will tell you that this is the ultimate balance between independence and accountability. Let's move to the fourth and final system, and I'm going to spend a little more time on this one, in part because it's the most widely used system, and in part because I've got some great video that I'm going to show you that will either horrify you or make you laugh, or possibly both. Twenty-two states in the union use contested elections between candidates to choose their judges. And that is exactly what it sounds like. That means that you put your name on the ballot, you go down to your board of elections before filing day, you put your name on the ballot, and one or two or 12 other people might be doing the same thing, and you might have a primary, you might have a runoff, and if you're lucky, you'll have a general election, and you will win or lose the campaign. So it looks just like a, or you know, it is treated just like a campaign for any other legislative branch or executive branch office, head-to-head campaigns. Now, there's a split in the 22 states. There are 9 states where candidates run openly with partisan affiliation. And that means that they can go on the campaign trail and say, you know, I'm Judge Joe Young and I'm a Republican, vote for me. In those 9 states, the voters also, when they walk into the ballot box, see on the ballot what that judge's affiliation is, whether they're a Republican or Democrat, or neither. And the proponents of this system will argue that this gives the voter more information than they would otherwise have, that this gives them at least a clue as to what this person's political philosophy is. Critics would say that's nice, but judges aren't supposed to be ruling based on which political party they represent. They're supposed to represent rule of law, as we talked about earlier. So what place does partisanship have in a judicial campaign? So those are the two sides of that argument. There are 13 states that use nonpartisan elections, and that means exactly the opposite of what partisan is. It means that like a for a school board or for a mayoral campaign, you show up as a voter and there are people on the ballot who are running for a judgeship, and they don't have a party label next to their name. And of course, so the critics would say, well, you're going to vote for somebody and you've got no idea what their party is. How do you know anything about them? It puts a huge burden on the average voter to find out information before they get into the polling booth about that particular candidate for judicial office. And the other side will say, that's how we keep politics out of the courts, right? You're not supposed to have political labels on there, so why would you put them on the ballot? So partisan and nonpartisan elections. And these systems are all very entrenched and established. And when I say that, I'm referring to both the contested elections and the three other kinds that I've talked about. It has been a long, long time since any state in this country moved from one of these systems to another one of these systems. And the reason for that is simple, which is that it requires a state constitutional amendment, which is a huge political hurdle. And with the way that most state legislatures are divided, very unlikely that that will pass in any state legislature. And of course, in I think every state, maybe every state but one, after an amendment to the Constitution is passed, it has to go to the voters, and then they have to approve it, sometimes by a supermajority. Very, very, very tall hurdle to pass a constitutional amendment, either federally or in the states. And so you don't see much movement amongst the 50 states in which systems they're using. They're pretty much stuck where they are. Now, let's talk for a few more minutes about contested elections, and I'll get into some of the details here. Proponents of judicial elections will tell you that they prioritize accountability, and that this is where the accountability in the system is the greatest, because it's a wide open system, and if a judge is not doing their job, the voters can kick that person out. If the judge is being too political, then a political race can be raised against them, and they can be removed from office. And so ultimately, the accountability is very, very strong. You know, it's up to the voters whether that judge is going to be on the bench. On the other side of the argument, in these sorts of systems, there are questions that get raised about whether the best judge wins an election. Maybe you're a great judge, and maybe you're a terrible campaigner, right? There's the critics will say, you know, there's no synchronicity between being a good judge and being a good political candidate. And so what do you get in a low information election like this? You get people who either don't vote, and you get a great deal of what political analysts call voter roll-off or drop-off. And that's where you go down the ballot and you pick your candidate for president and your candidate for Senate and your candidate for Congress and your state legislature, and then you stop. Because all these other names down below for all these other offices, no idea who they are, not interested. And so you get a much smaller portion of the electorate making choices. Those people who do vote tend to be a much smaller portion of the electorate. And so you get a drop-off or a roll-off anywhere between 30 and 50% of the voters who just don't vote. And then you can argue that one, too. I mean, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Maybe people who don't know what they're voting for shouldn't be just guessing. What are you going to vote on? Whether you like somebody's name? Whether you saw a yard sign that you thought was good? I mean, that's not really being an informed voter, but for these down ballot elections, that is often what voters are faced with in terms of the extent of their information. Now, there's also a lot of criticism of judicial elections because of some of the side effects that happen in political campaigns. And that's where those who cherish or who will say that they put independence first say they have concerns about judicial elections because the side effects of running a political campaign for office lead many to question the independence of those who then get elected. To put this very bluntly, if you get elected in a campaign for a state Supreme Court and you've received $3 million from the trial lawyers, and all these cases come before you being brought by the trial lawyers, what are you going to do? Well, our system needs to function, and you can't expect every judge to step aside in every case and say, I have a conflict of interest. And so a lot of these conflicts start to crop up and make those who are critics of judicial elections really uneasy. Now, I want to give you a little bit of more detail on what's been happening in judicial elections because it's interesting and entertaining, and this is where I have much more of my data. So there is, of course, a big national conversation that's been going on about the effect of the U.S. Supreme Court case in Citizens United, which was decided, I think, in 2011? Is that right? I should know this. It was decided several years ago, and it has greatly freed the ability of people to put money into political campaigns without limits, and for not just people, but also for corporations and other entities and unions and so on to contribute to political campaigns. And so this has accelerated the concern that those who are worried about these effects have because the amount of money has gone up. And so here we have Lady Justice being snowed under a dump truck of cash. And that's, I thought, was kind of funny. In the most recent election cycle, according to a recent report, 21 of the 23 campaigns for a state Supreme Court position, which tend to be where most of the attention gets focused and where most of the energy gets focused because state Supreme Courts make more binding decisions than lower court judges do. In 21 of the 23 campaigns, the winner was the candidate who spent the most money, right? And so that's, again, another piece of criticism from those who don't like judicial elections saying, this isn't really about who's going to be the best judge. This is about who's going to be the best fundraiser. For your information, the five most expensive states for these campaigns in 2013 and 2014 were the following five: Michigan, North Carolina, Texas, Illinois, and Ohio. And those are all pretty big states, right? So not a big surprise. They are all big states. They have statewide elections. It costs a lot of money to run for any office in those states. So that's where the judicial campaigns were the most expensive in 2013 and 2014. This is a breakdown of not the total, doesn't show you the total amount of money that was spent, but what it shows you is where the money that was contributed to these campaigns and was spent in these campaigns, where it's coming from. And you can see that the biggest portion of this pie chart, 59.8%, is still coming from candidate fundraising. But there's a growing piece of this pie, and that 29.4%, so we'll call it 30%, or almost one out of every $3, is no longer being spent by either the candidates or by their political parties that are supporting them. It's being spent by outside special interest groups that are running independent campaigns. And increasingly, the judicial elections in America are seeing the influence of these independent groups. And this was the case before the Citizens United decision, but is accelerating to a new level. One other point about the finances in these campaigns, and I know that's very hard to read, so I'm going to just try and articulate it for you, is that increasingly the campaigns are also being, I don't want to say controlled because that's not the right word, but the spenders are becoming more concentrated. In other words, the people who make the biggest contributions are having a larger influence on the campaigns than they have historically. So in the 2012 cycle, and I have a chart up here that actually says 13, but in the 2012 election cycle, 10 spenders, a combination of individuals and special interest groups, 10 individual entities accounted for 40% of all the spending in all of the judicial elections in America. So you see this influence, perhaps, of the concentration of money in these campaigns. Okay, I'm doing okay on time. That's good. But I want to turn to what is both the entertaining and perhaps the horrifying part. And I'm going to have Jim come up here and work the computer. Another component of judicial elections is the reality of advertising. Because if you're going to run a campaign and you want to get votes, you need to let people know who you are. And so television ads are now pretty much a staple, a mainstay in state Supreme Court elections, at least. And in addition to the candidates running their own ads, you won't be surprised to hear that some of these independent groups are now running their ads, too, as they try to influence the outcome of elections. So, Jim, there's four of them there. I'm going to run them pretty much in sequence so that you get the flavor of these and then make a few comments. So go ahead with the first one.
State Supreme Court, and you ought to find judges who are
fair and impartial,
upholding our Constitution, but not Jim Johnson. You'll find him in the pocket of big corporations, taking $100,000 from one big business donor alone, and Big Tobacco, working to weaken the voter-approved smoking ban, and Tim Iman, writing and defending one Iman initiative after corporations, taking $100,000 from one big business donor alone, and Big Tobacco, working to weaken the voter-approved smoking ban, and Tim Iman, writing and defending one Iman initiative after another. Vote Tuesday, August 17th against Jim Johnson and his special deals for special interests.
Okay, well, while Jim works on the video, let me just, I'll insert some comments, and Jim, let me know if you can get it working. You heard some of the audio there, but you really have to see the visuals to understand the message that's being conveyed, and it is funny, so hopefully we'll have a chance to look at these. But one of the trends, and Terry and I were talking about this when we had lunch a little while ago, one of the trends in these ads is, of course, most voters are focused on law and order issues. They're interested in the criminal justice system, and they're interested in public safety. They're interested in being protected from criminals. And so a lot of the themes of these ads, especially when they attack particular judges, focus on criminal justice themes or particular cases that a judge might have authored, you know, at some point in their career. But very seldom does the money that finances these ads come from a victim's rights group or, you know, from some other criminal justice organization. They tend to come from one side or the other in the civil justice battle, the tort battle. And they know that if they make television ads about tort reform, everybody's eyes will glaze over. But if they can figure out how to make a catchy ad that makes it look like a judge is a horrible person, that's something that's going to stick in a voter's memory when they go to vote. So are we going to try again?
Trying to repeat that just so people can see it?
Yeah, let's go back with the first one because it's the funny one.
Go to Washington State Supreme Court and you ought to find judges who are
fair and impartial,
upholding our Constitution,
but not Jim Johnson. You'll find him in the pocket of big corporations, taking $100,000 from one big business donor alone, and Big Tobacco, working to weaken the voter-approved smoking ban, and Tim Iman, writing and defending one Iman initiative after another. Vote Tuesday, August 17th against Jim Johnson and his special deals for special interests.
So there you go, in the pocket of special interests, politicking in state Supreme Court elections. That was from Washington State. The next one is from North Carolina, and this one ran in this most recent election campaign. Go ahead.
We want judges to protect us. When child molesters sued to stop electronic monitoring of their locations, a law that let us track child molesters near schools, playgrounds, daycare centers, Supreme Court Justice Robin Hudson sided with the predators. Hudson cited a child molester's right to privacy and took the side of the convicted molesters. Justice Robin Hudson, not tough on child molesters, not fair to victims.
So this was a big ad because, for various reasons, as you can probably guess, this ad actually ended up in the New York Times because it was considered so outrageous, and in part because of the entity that was funding it had nothing to do with victims' rights, as I was saying a moment ago. And it was obviously a very strong ad, but in case you're wondering, Judge Hudson did win re-election. She did not get beaten. So they're not always effective. They're oftentimes effective, but not every single time. All right, which one we have next? Okay, so this is a similar one targeting a judge in Illinois.
I was convicted of stabbing my victims with a kitchen knife.
Of shooting my ex-girlfriend and murdering her sister in front of our child.
Of sexual assault on a mom and her 10-year-old daughter. Then I slashed their throats.
On appeal, Justice Thomas Kilbride sided with us.
Over law enforcement or victims.
Other judges overruled Kilbride and our appeals were denied.
Kilbride chose criminals' rights over and over again. Way more than any other justice. Vote no on retention of Thomas Kilbride. Vote down ballot. It's a top priority.
So that one's interesting because of what you heard at the end there. So that was a judge who was in the retention system where he only had a yes or a no. And you heard the voiceover at the end show you, first off, the visual showed you to go down to the bottom of the ballot and to check no. And then the voiceover says, go down to the bottom of the ballot because it's a priority. And that's their effort to try to make sure that people aren't walking away from the ballot before going down to vote. So I think we've got one more.
Yes.
And this one's from Michigan.
At just 17 years old, Patty Rozanski was brutally raped and strangled. Thomas Kress was sentenced to life in prison for her murder until Democrat Supreme Court candidate Bridget McCormick successfully fought for the release of this convicted killer. While Patty's family continues to grieve, Bridget McCormick was elated and thrilled that the man convicted of her murder walked free. Bridget McCormick, the wrong choice for Michigan families.
So in this particular sample, I think that I've sort of picked on the Republican side of things, but I that's not intentional. That was just what I happened to find on my computer the other day when I was looking through things. Because the other side of this is well represented too, and there are trial lawyers groups that are doing the same thing, and liberal and democratic groups that are running the same sorts of campaigns. So please don't interpret what I've showed as being the entire sample. There's equal opportunity offending going on here, I can assure you of that. All right, so go back to, we're getting towards the end here, and we're going to leave some time for questions and answers. This visual here just points out the point that I've been making, which is that that red bar on the left represents the number of ads that focused on criminal justice themes as a topic for their TV ads. And then there are other topics like the role of judges, family values, civil justice, individual decisions, and then conservative values as a theme. Those ads, there are a lot of those ads, but the growth in the focus on criminal justice in the last election cycle is quite striking. As you can see, that's gone way, way up. So, again, this is just to quickly recap, and I think I probably have spent too much time on this fourth category, but it is where there's the most action. Who is engaging in these campaigns? Well, this is an example of some of the groups that are so-called special interests. And you can call them special interests, or you can call them interest groups, you can call them whatever you want. The point is that they're organized politically and they're active. And so you've got Americans for Prosperity, which is a conservative group, America Votes, which is a liberal group, Human Rights Campaign, which is a gay advocacy organization. Law Enforcement Alliance of America is pretty much exactly what you would think. So those are just some examples of some of the entities that are now getting engaged in judicial elections because they see that the outcomes of these campaigns are resulting in judicial officers who then have a bearing on their issues when they take their cases to court. Why else would they be involved in these campaigns? The United States Supreme Court has spent a little bit of time over the last 10 years looking at whether there is anything that that will be different in judicial elections. And for the most part, the U.S. Supreme Court has tended towards deregulation of the campaigns. And that's not something that is just the last couple of years. This goes all the way back to the first case on this list here, Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, which was a case from 2002, which had to do with whether or not a candidate for a judicial office in Minnesota had the First Amendment right to talk about which political party they were in. And the court ruled that that they did, that that in spite of the fact that Minnesota has a canon, a code of ethics that says that you can't, the United States Supreme Court in 2002 said, yeah, if you're going to run for an office, public office, you've got a First Amendment right to tell people which party you're in. So that was what that case represented. And as a result of that, we've seen more judicial candidates taking advantage of that liberty and freedom and talking about their political affiliation. I've talked a bit about Citizens United. I'm not going to spend much time on that. But the middle case is very interesting and probably one you haven't heard of. This is a case out of West Virginia. And it's a gentleman named Hugh Caperton who filed a lawsuit against the Massey Coal Company, which is one of the largest coal companies in the country. And the suit had to do with whether or not try and explain this in a way that is straightforward enough. I'll back up a little bit here and say that the CEO of the Massey Coal Company spent $3 million in a judicial election campaign to promote the candidacy of a challenger in a political campaign for the Supreme Court. That judge won the election. And that judge then cast the deciding vote in a 3-2 case overturning a settlement that had gone in Caperton's favor and went back to Massey's favor. And so the argument, in essence, was, should this judge not have disqualified himself from the case because of the contribution to the campaign? Very interesting case, because the contribution did not go to the judge. It was money that was spent independently in favor of that judge's candidacy, and the judge said, I had nothing to do with that. That wasn't my doing, you know, and that should not look poorly upon me, and I can be fair and impartial in this particular case. So that is a case in which the United States Supreme Court disagreed with that and overturned it and sent it back to West Virginia to be reheard. So those are some of the major United States Supreme Court opinions around judicial selection in the last couple of years. And I have talked an awful lot. I didn't expect to talk this much. I wanted to share one more piece of data with you, which will not be a surprise. This comes from a poll of American public opinion a little while back, which when people were asked whether they thought that campaign contributions made to a judge have an impact on their decision in the courtroom, you had 87% of the respondents saying, yeah, I think that probably has an impact on that judge's decision. So this poll has been, this kind of question has been asked for years and years and years, and you always see a number like this, 80%, 90%. And the concern that the advocates of restraining judicial elections will tell you is not that it really matters whether the judge is fair or impartial, but it's the public perception that the judge can't be fair, and because support for the court system is based almost exclusively on public trust and confidence in the courts, if you have a system of judicial selection that arguably undermines or corrodes that perception, then you're potentially harming people's public trust. So that's the argument. There are lots of arguments on the other side that I think I've summarized about why judicial elections are good, which is they provide the voters with more information. They provide them with a much higher degree of accountability, and it allows more First Amendment rights for the candidates. So with that said, I have reached the end of my slides, and I hope I haven't exhausted you. This has been like a 12-round grudge match on judicial selection. As always, I think that each of these systems has a strength and a weakness, and you have to look at the pendulum between independence and accountability and which of those values you put a higher weight on as to which system you think is going to work better. And there is an ongoing public discussion and debate in the states for hundreds of years about which of these systems or other systems best weigh out independence and accountability. And that is a conversation that we are in the middle of and that is not going away, and it'll be with us for some time to come. So that concludes my presentation. I thank you for your kind attention, and I'm looking forward to questions.
As is our custom, we are podcasting this. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and one of our officers will come by and give you a microphone. And when you got the microphone, ask your question. Any questions?
I'm just curious about whether when voters are voting for a judge, the kind of information that's made available to them, and if there's any opportunity for public discussion on various issues, and also if are they required to list the kinds of people or organizations that have donated to their campaign and the amount of money that's been donated?
I assume you're talking about elections here, right?
Yes.
Okay, so there are actually probably three questions inside that one question. I'll try to unpack that. The first question as to how much, what information do they get, what's made available. Generally speaking, as a general rule, there is no information that is provided by the state, per se. There are some states that have attempted to go that road, and North Carolina was one of those states where they put together a statewide voter's guide, and each candidate had a chance to write something up, and they got mailed to every house in the state. There are some efforts to do that. Increasingly, that is being delegated to civic organizations, so that it's not necessarily the state that's doing it, but you might have the League of Women Voters, for instance, that organizes information like that. Candidates' forms, they do have them. They are dry as toast. Because what can a judge really tell you other than very basic information about who they are and their family and what kind of law they might have practiced? Generally speaking, judges don't want to get into too many details because it's against the code of ethics to prejudge cases. And they don't want to suggest that they have made up their minds on things. And that's one of the tensions in the system between having people want information and need information to make informed votes, and while also trying to uphold the fairness and the impartiality of the system. Remind me of the last part of the question again. Are they required to disclose? The answer is yes. They're all public officials. They have to file state disclosure forms like any other officer or any other candidate for state office. And in some states, that's done really well. In some states, that's done online, on the internet, in practically real time. Some states have laws that say that if you get a contribution of, say, more than $5,000, you have to disclose that inside of 24 hours. And a lot of states, if you want that information, you can go down to the Board of Elections office and you can spend 25 cents a photocopy. And so it varies.
As a historian, I would like to know, because you grouped these together and you didn't, with the exception of the two, Virginia and South Carolina, you didn't mention the others, are they in particular pockets of the country? Did they take their guidelines from the next door neighbor? I mean, states became states over a long period of time,
right.
So I'm curious how that happened.
It's a great question, and it's not perfect, but there is a little, you can see a little bit of alignment. If I were to put it on a map, you would see that the, so take Virginia and South Carolina off because there are just two of them, but the other three major groups, the collection of 10 states, which is focused on appointment, that is for the most part found in the Northeast, in the original colonies, in Massachusetts, in Delaware, and Rhode Island. The elections, 22 states, that's widespread across the country, tends to be concentrated in the South and the Midwest for the contested elections. And then the Missouri plan system, which is the hybrid of appointment with a retention election, that's modeled throughout, but it's also mostly Midwest, West. So California, I want to say, no, Oregon's not, California. And a lot of the other states in between California and the East Coast are the Missouri plan systems.
Hawaii and Alaska.
Those are both, Alaska and Hawaii are both Missouri plan systems. And there was a wave of change in the country in the 60s and 70s where a lot of states went from the contested elections to the Missouri plan, and then it stopped. And I don't think any state has made a change in 40 years.
I have two distinct questions. You started to speak initially about where your funding came from, but you ended up only mentioning the USAID part for foreign sources. Or foreign activities. But I guess my other question is, I tried to bone up a little bit before coming, and California and New Jersey end up on a couple of lists with Virginia and South Carolina as having governor or legislative appointment systems. And how do California and New Jersey differ then?
New Jersey, I want to say, is I want to say it's an appointment system. I think the distinction to make is that in Virginia and in South Carolina, there is literally a roll call of the legislature to choose the judge. They've got it's an up or down vote in the legislature. In some of those other states, like New Jersey, I think it's an appointment that comes from outside of the legislature. And then I'm speaking off the cuff here. I know that there's a legislative component in New Jersey, but I don't know what it is. So it goes back to my point at the outset that there is a lot of variations across the 50 systems, and I've tried to group them into the biggest four groups that I could think of. So California is what is called a merit selection Missouri plan state, I believe. And then as to your question about our funding, let me give you a little more information on that. We've got, so I mentioned the money that comes from USAID to do work overseas. We get a substantial amount of money from grants and contracts for doing works directly in the states. We get revenue from hosting conferences. We also get money from private sources like private foundations to do research projects. And we get private contributions from individual citizens because we're a 501c3 not-for-profit charity. And so people can give us money and get a tax break. Hint, hint. Does that help? Yeah.
So if judges in any of the 50 states contacted you and there was an issue that they wanted research done on, do you voluntarily do research when you're requested to do that? Is there a contract involved? How does that work?
It varies. If it's a pretty minor question, we actually have a division in our organization that is a service to the state courts, which is an information services department. And so we have, if you look at our website, we have like 100 different topics that we keep information on. And that's available to the public. It's available to any person who works in the courts who wants it. For work that is more specific, more state specific, more project specific, that's where we will enter into a contract to do that. We don't fund that ourselves.
Is the four categories you talked about, forgetting Virginia and South Carolina, they all have some kind of an election, whether it's a affirmation that the person's doing a good job, whatever. Right. Is the really big money sort of vicious advertising and so forth pretty much in the category where the judges run for election, or is it distributed over all those?
The
sort of badness of the...
The badness? The data would tell you that most of the money exists in the contested elections, and that concentrated within that, there's more money when the campaigns are partisan. That's where most of it goes. I mean, there's money in all of it, but that's where the majority of it would go. Yeah.
Are there further questions? Yes, ma'am.
There's also money in Virginia elections because money goes to the legislator who selects the judge.
Right.
And legislators can be very opinionated, and also legislators can be beholden to special interests. And therefore, another factor is if any of us had to go to court before a judge, wouldn't we want to have the delegate that selected him as our attorney?
I'm not going to touch that one.
Other questions? Well, I guess that concludes it. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Derek. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.